ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here in the Country Hour chair for one more day. Coming up very soon. Yesterday, with the stroke of a pen, the state government ended dingo and wild dog control in the northwest of the state. So what's that going to mean for livestock producers? Also in political news, the government is fast-tracking $90 billion in renewable energy projects in a move that predictably has made a lot of people really angry. And you'll hear from a 12-year-old who's already outpaced his dad on the handpiece.
I love the long blow on the last side, like just taking the wool off.
Get in touch 0467 842 722. The state government has lifted an order that enabled farmers in the northwest of the state to protect their livestock from dingoes. As of yesterday, dingoes or wild dogs are not permitted to be culled on private nor public land. Farmers in eastern Victoria can still control dingoes and wild dogs, although that unprotection order, as it's known, lapses in October. Peter Starr, Vice President of the Victorian Farmers Federation Livestock Group, says it's a political decision and the $550,000 on the table for things like exclusion fencing won't go far.
Look, in some ways I wasn't surprised. It's how the department and this government operate. Unfortunately, no consultation. Nothing. You know, the reality is that next week there's meant to be a gathering of, you know, like-minded people to discuss the issue of the unprotection of the dingo. The government's just gone now and made this decision in regard to the West and just totally ridiculous. Just no, as I said before, no consultation. You know, the government's offering a $550,000 compensation package. Well, I would suggest to the government that they look at the example that's been done in Queensland and, you know, the cost somewhere out there. I was out there 10 years ago with the National Wild Dog Group and, you know, that cost of that fencing was somewhere in $8,500 to $10,000 a kilometre. You know, if the Victorian government wants to get serious about protecting dingoes, open your checkbook. I think the next thing is basically what science is it based on? It's based on a hypothesis by Kylie Cairns that the work done by a lady by the name of Danielle Stevens over 10 years ago, who more or less said that dingoes in Victoria were probably less than 5% pure dingo, or wild dogs were less than 5% pure dingo, are now 95%. You know, what a load of bunkum. But this is what this is based on. Absolute pie in the sky. We love dingoes. We're going to make sure that we get them protected all over Victoria. Keep in mind that in Victoria is the only state in Australia where actually dingoes are recognised as a species. Everywhere else, they are just a wild dog. Another breed of dog, you know, just absolute garbage. You know, hello, welcome to Victoria, where idiots seem to get their voice in front of common sense, real life, everyday people.
What's it going to mean for those livestock producers in the northwest who have wild dogs or dingoes killing their animals?
Well, they've just got to take, you know, more or less, they've got to take the action to control these as coming back onto their own property. You know, will the fences work? You know, it's been proven in the northeast. You know, electric fencing, guardian animals, people do have them. But at the same time, they're more or less saying it doesn't do the full job to be totally competent that our livestock are protected. We have to have the wild dog control measures working in the background on the public land. Well, guess what? In northwest Victoria, the actions on public land have been taken away.
Just explain what it's like to have animals killed by wild dogs or dingoes.
Oh, look, it is the most heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching thing to come upon, you know, to get up early in the morning, go out, check round your flock and just see lambs torn to pieces, ewes with their guts hanging out. It is not a pretty sight. you know, it is heartbreaking to have to live with this scenario of having to deal with wild dogs. The Victorian government has just made it harder.
This only applies to the northwest at this stage, but the unprotection order for eastern Victoria is only in place until October this year. Are you concerned that it will be removed come October?
Angus, I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned that there is just people out there who will not listen to common sense. As I said, I think it's next Tuesday. There's a meeting of both sides of the wild dog argument somewhere here in Melbourne to discuss this issue, to ratify the science. You know, there's scientists that say, yes, they're purebred dingoes. There are other scientists that just say that this is a load of rubbish, that, you know, it's just pie in the sky. But, you know, welcome to Victoria. Welcome where we've got this crossbench in the high upper house that's holding the balance of power. You know, we're just kowtowing to them. You know, it's the Labor Party kowtowing to them just to get other policy over the line. You know, keep these bloody radicals happy, and this is what we have to do, you know, at the sake of Victorian farmers.
So where to from here, and is there anything you can do to push back against this?
Probably not a hell of a lot we can do to push back. You know, I guess the plea is listen to common sense. Keep in mind that, you know, the livelihood and the mental stability of your farmers that are affected by wild dogs throughout this state is just an absolute joke, Angus.
That was Peter Starr, Vice President of the VFF Livestock Group, responding there to the news that came through yesterday that the Victorian government has removed that ability for farmers and rangers to control dingoes and wild dogs in northwest Victoria. Well, Darren Smith runs sheep and cattle and grows crops at Patchawalik, right in the middle of that zone. His property borders the eastern side of the national park there, and he says he may have to switch to an operation that is 100% cropping if dingo populations increase.
In the past, we've had some very bad losses. One particular area just south of Patchawalik, where we joined the park there, we had a mob of 200 sheep we brought in, and over a course of 18 months, we lost between 60 and 70 of them. And nearly all the sheep you end up saving, they end up being cripples or there's a problem with them. It's pretty hard to, once a dog's bitten a sheep, it's pretty hard to get them back right again.
And what kind of control methods have you used to protect your animals?
We've only mainly used baits, and the last couple of years, 2 or 3 years, we've had a trapper, and he sets traps and monitors and things like that. We don't set traps, we just bait when we get baits.
Under the changes that have been announced by the Victorian government on Thursday, dingoes will be protected in northwest Victoria, but there will be some funding available for non-lethal control methods. Would you be interested in putting in some of those methods on your property, things like exclusion fencing and guardian animals and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, the guardian animals, I've got a couple of them. We still get dog attacks with them. I've got, some running in a mob, that worst area. I've ran guardian animals there and we've still had dog attacks with them. I think they do help a little bit, but like instead of they might not wipe out 10 sheep in a night, they might only wipe out one or two. I think that the alpacas must stir them up, and I'm not sure, but that's the only thing I can relate to with that. But exclusion fencing, that it's going to have to be a bloody good fence, and then we've got trouble with kangaroos. They'll dig holes under it, so it'll be an ongoing job maintaining that fence to keep them out. Any small hole, they'll find a way in, especially this time of year in the autumn. Dogs seem to be around a lot more. Right at present, we haven't had any attacks for a bit, which is good. But I'm half expecting with this last couple of warm weeks that they'll come in for water shortly, because it'll be drying. Any surface water that may have been laying around will be all gone.
And given that you've been doing wild dog control, what's the population of the animals like at the moment? And what do you think it might be like if that control was removed?
Well, it'll be like it was 10 years ago. They'll be everywhere. The older dogs are hard to get, but if we put baits out yearly, we always seem to kill the young pups. They haven't learnt the trick of the trade then, and they're pretty easy to get, those dogs. But if you got it in the older dogs, they're the ones that are pretty cunning to traps. They're the ones that are pretty cunning to baits. So they're the ones that usually cause all the problems. And the young dogs are usually the dogs that we see about. And they're quite easy to usually get. It's the older dogs that'll be the issue. And they'll just build up numbers. It's a big area of scrub. And you get areas like years like we've just had with two wet summers. They'll breed up 100 mile an hour.
What do you expect the financial impact would be? Obviously, you'd save some money on if you didn't have to pay a trapper, but you'd be losing money if you were losing livestock. What do you think the cost benefit would be to your business?
There'll be no cost benefits. It'll be a big cost. I can see a lot of areas that join the national park, which is a long area, like a kilometre from the park. No one will run livestock. So if your farms join the park, you'll be game to run livestock there, especially after a year or two when the numbers build back up again.
Would you consider switching to a farm that's all cropping?
Yeah, well, there's quite a few people have done that here. I've got a neighbour on the south of Patchewite. He doesn't run any sheep where the dogs are now, just cropping. For that reason, he said, I can't run sheep there. So we've got some cattle we run on one property what joins it for that reason. Yeah, no, the people will just go out of sheep along where it joins the park.
That was Patchewaluk farmer Darren Smith speaking with Elsie Kennedy. I'm sure you would like to get the government's response to this decision, maybe a justification for why they have decided to end dingo and wild dog control in the northwest of the state. Well, of course, we'd like to bring that to you. We've tried this morning. We've contacted the Ag Minister's office. That's Ros Spence. Yet to hear back there. And mind you, I don't believe that we've had the Ag Minister on the Country Hour since he was appointed back in October. Despite numerous attempts by us, we're continually stonewalled. Nothing. Radio silence. Well, this order was also made by the Environment Minister, so Steve Demopoulos, we thought, we'll give him a try. We were referred back to the Ag Minister's office. So, again, nothing. The Premier, Jacinta Allen, she was speaking at a press conference this morning, so we thought, okay, we'll put a question to her as to... And the question we did put was to whether the wild dog order that's been applied in the northwest will be applied in Gippsland and the northeast, where there are more wild dogs. Well, just have a listen to this snippet.
Order that wild dogs and dingoes be protected in the northwest. Will you rule out applying the same rules to Gippsland and the northeast?
I'll have that Environment Minister come back and speak to that. Okay, very good. Thank you.
The Environment Minister. We tried them, referred back to the Ag Minister, and we've heard nothing. So as it stands right now, we won't have a government response on this story for you. On the text line, Jono on the borderline says, regarding wild dogs, hi Angus, June 2022, I tagged 185 new lambs. By November 2022, I had 66 left. That's why I've quit producing, that on top of the cost of production. Thanks, Jono. And RW on the text line says, well said, old mate, in reference, I think, to the earlier interview we had with Peter Starr from VFF Livestock Group, 0467. 842-722 is the text line. Well, let's hear now from people in support of this decision, because the Australian Dingo Foundation has welcomed the news. It says the decision is vindication of that research last year by Kylie Cairns from the University of New South Wales that found the vast majority of wild dogs are dingoes. Mel Browning, director with the Australian Dingo Foundation, says the decision has been a long time coming.
This is momentous for dingo protection. We are so delighted, and we want to congratulate the Victorian government on this decision. After 236 years of relentless persecution of our native apex land predator, the dingo, to have a population that has had some serious protection put in place is extraordinary and heartwarming. And we hope that this is a step forward that's going to lead to further protections for other critically endangered remnant dingo populations around Australia and in the rest of Victoria.
Was this a surprise, or did you know it was coming?
We had an inkling. Dr. Kylie Cairns released a DNA research paper back in May last year, And I think that set in motion a lot of kind of things behind the scenes. So what her research showed was that the Australian mainland is not overrun with feral wild dogs, that the degree of hybridisation of dingoes in the wild is minimal, and that dingoes breed with dingoes. They don't breed with domestic dogs, or rarely breed with domestic dogs. And if they do, any domestic dog genes are quickly bred out of wild populations because nature selects the dingo genes. Dingoes are built for form and function for their role as apex predators. So what's interesting about the Northwest dingoes or the Big Desert dingoes, what Kylie found is that population was a genetically distinct population. All the samples that came out of there were 100% pure dingo.
What's this going to mean, though, for livestock producers, sheep farmers in the area who now no longer will have those lethal control options available to them?
Well, they will. They've got to have an authority to control wildlife, but it's the last resort. What is wonderful is the Victorian government have thought about the farmers. There is $550,000 going towards trialling a whole range of non-lethal measures for those farmers. And really, honestly, killing dingoes is not an effective solution to protecting sheep.
If, as you say, dingoes are genetically distinct from wild dogs, aren't there also wild dogs in that area?
No, there's not. So this is the big myth in Australia that we have, you know, wild places that are overrun with, you know, feral dogs that have escaped and bred up in the wild. Domestic dogs, we've been breeding domestic dogs for tens of thousands of years for, you know, they've been shaped by humans, so they've lost those wild instincts. So what's living in the wild are predominantly pure dingoes and all pure dingoes in the Big Desert area. And across the rest of Australia, mostly pure dingoes or very high content dingoes. Domestic dogs don't have those instincts and those smarts.
This change only applies to northwest Victoria. Do you want it to be rolled out across the state?
We'd love to see the other remnant populations also protected, but you know we're very aware that this is a massive change for farmers and it's going to be an adjustment. And we hope that the unprotection order is repealed across the rest of the state, and that again the Victorian government chooses to support farmers in moving to non-lethal protection.
This is really political, isn't it? And if there is a change of government at the state level in Victoria, won't this decision be reversed?
Well, we hope not. That would be just devastating.
That was Mel Browning, director with the Australian Dingo Foundation, on this news that came out late yesterday that the state government has revoked that ability for farmers and rangers in northwest Victoria to control wild dogs and dingoes. As I mentioned earlier, we tried to get a response from the government the Premier referred us to the Environment Minister, the Environment Minister referred us to the Ag Minister, and we've had no response from the Ag Minister's office. So we can't bring you a government justification for this move. On the text line, Bob in the Northwest says, I will still be shooting dingoes when the new law comes in. We did hear in that interview there that would technically be possible legally if you did get an authority to control wildlife, but that is at the discretion of the conservation regulator and only as a last resort, so I'm not sure how feasible it would be to get that permission. Nigel in Vesper says, afternoon, Angus, roll on the next election. Perhaps a load of dead, mutilated sheep on Spring Street is what's needed. Thanks for your text, Nigel. And Steve in Bambara says, Angus, Jacinta Allen has all the mannerisms of her hero, Dan Andrews. Thanks, Steve. And Maggie says, Angus, what's the cost of mental anguish to farmers for sheep being mauled, ripped apart by dingo attacks? Hey, government, city people, why don't we all just stop farming in Australia? Let it all go wild. Good luck on getting food or materials to live. Thanks for that, Maggie. Jungle Jim says, dingoes, just another introduced species. And this person, no name, but they say, as a person on the ground up in northern Victoria, that's who we'd love to hear from, keep in mind it's not only the baiting of dogs, it also affects the removal of foxes out of the area too. So there goes the small marsupials, like hopping mice, that will now be endangered. They'd have to come back in large numbers. This person, the Victorian government, has lost the plot. Go out to the regions where feral dogs attack sheep and get a sense of what's actually happening. And another texter says, "Hi Angus, what a joke, the Ag Minister not coming on the radio. Best she be sacked." And another texter saying, "Dingoes are not even an Australian native animal." 0467 842 722 is the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We'll keep talking about that issue, but in the meantime, rural communities across Victoria are angry at the state government's plans to accelerate renewable energy projects. In a bid to build 90% worth of developments that have been held up in red tape, the government says projects will be eligible to be fast-tracked under a new scheme. But farmers are concerned about the removal of the independent planning panel process, and that includes third-party appeals to the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. For several years now, Torello potato farmer Catherine Myers has been fighting proposed renewable energy infrastructure that would run through her property. She spoke with reporter Jane McNaughton.
Look, it's a really concerning step forward. We saw last year Minister D'Ambrosio remove the right to challenge or appeal transmission infrastructure being constructed, and now we've removed the right to appeal or have our concerns heard about renewable energy developments in the state as well.
How does that emotionally make you feel, considering that you've been on this battle front for a number of years now?
It really feels like death by a thousand cuts. We had a meeting with Minister D'Ambrosio yesterday where we were discussing some other legislative changes that are taking place. Didn't mention this one, but there's a lot coming in the pipeline, and I really am concerned that we've just got this constant erosion of property rights here in Victoria, and it's setting a fairly concerning precedent for other areas.
According to the government, this now means that once a complete application is lodged of one of the new state significant projects, decisions can be made within 4 months.
That's pretty quick. That's really quick for projects that can have a really significant material detriment to a business. We know the planning legislation is there to protect not only the natural environment, but also the social and economic environment that our rural communities and Victoria sits in. 4 months is not long to assess the planning proposal that can then no longer be challenged in the future.
There is, however, apparently since 2015, more than one in five applications of this kind have ended up in VCAT. The government's saying that that's currently worth around $90 billion worth of investment. There's got to be a better way than this, though, doesn't there, for things just to be held up in VCAT forever?
I think that absolutely highlights how broken the process is. We know Andrew Dyer himself recorded in his recent report, and he referred to renewable energy developers as cowboys of the industry. There's some really poor behaviour out there, and there's some really poor planning proposals going forward and being rubber stamped. That VCAT process has been essential in making sure the concerns of landholders and environmentalists and all kinds of different community groups get heard if they get missed in that early planning process.
So what do you think consultation looks like under this new model?
I think consultation actually looks like communication. I think it's about telling communities and landholders and environmental organisations what's going to happen. It's not about finding out what's out there and how we can work together in partnership.
You've been fighting against the Western Renewables Link for a number of years. That's obviously one of these projects that would be in this pipeline. Projects currently stuck in approval processes will also be able to access this accelerated pathway. Does that concern you?
Look, I am not sure if this is going to apply to transmission lines. We know that the minister's already rubber stamped that to go ahead and removed any kind of judicial oversight from that project, which we're still challenging in court. But it concerns me that we may see more developments occurring where we don't have transmission either planned or existing. So if we see more developments outside the existing energy grid, we're going to see more transmission requirements and more transmission developments in the future.
Just down the road in the Moyne Shire Council in southwest Victoria, that area is home to 310 operating wind turbines with another 410 under construction or in planning, covering around 12% of the land in that area. The mayor of that council is calling for a pause on all new developments until there's a strategic land use plan completed.
Would you go so far as to say that is necessary?
Absolutely. VicGrid are working on one at the moment. They've spent quite a few months slowly working up a map of Victoria and understanding where our key food generation and fibre generation areas are and where they need to be protected from renewable energy developments. And we've got to get this planning right now. We're at a point in our future and our planning where we need to get both our food security and our energy security right. We've got risks on both sides, and if we pursue one with blindfolds on, then we're going to muck up the other one.
The Victorian government and the federal government, though, have got pretty ambitious targets when it comes to meeting certain climate agreements. If all of these projects continue to be stalled, are you concerned that not only are those commitments not going to be met, but as we start shutting down coal-fired power stations and the like, that the lights are going to go out if these projects can't go ahead in some form?
Look, there's always concerns about our energy security, and we really need to transition both our energy generation and our transmission into the future. But we need to make sure that doesn't come at the cost of our food security. As much as we can't operate the lives we live now without energy, we can't operate it without food and without fibre as well. So we need to make sure both of those are protected. Farmers live by the weather, and that's our core business, but we also use power as well, and we need to make sure that we're not compounding any climatic effects by taking land out of food production.
The government says in the press release that they put out on Thursday afternoon that the voices of communities who want to raise concerns with a proposal will continue to be protected, that's a quote, and that third-party objections will still have a place in the approvals process, but this change prevents time-consuming and repeated delays that hold the projects back for years. Do you feel as though the voices of communities will still be heard?
If they're removing the VCAT proposal, I'm really keen to find out how they think they're going to be heard and how they're going to be included in a four-month planning process.
What's your message to the Victorian government today, Catherine?
It's just slow down, think about what you're doing, and make sure we don't make decisions that we regret in the future. These are decisions that are going to affect people for 20, 30, 40, 50 years into the future. We can't make them quickly and we can't make them urgently.
That was Torello, potato farmer and chair of the Victorian Farmers Federation's Planning, Environment and Climate Change Committee, Catherine Myers, speaking with Jane McNaughton. You can read more about that story on the ABC Rural website. And some of those points or questions that Catherine Myers was raising, we could have asked them of the government, couldn't we? We could have asked the Ag Minister, we could have asked the Environment Minister. Well, we asked both of those to come on and talk about the scrapping of the control of dingoes and wild dogs in northwest Victoria. Environment Minister referred us to the Ag Minister. Ag Minister, we haven't heard back, and that's just continuing the usual pattern. Since October last year, when Ros Spence was made Ag Minister, don't think she's been on the Country Hour. So, unfortunately, we can't put those questions to her, and you can't hear her responses. On the text line about wild dogs and dingoes, Dave at Lake Tyres says, Angus, the government's decision to end wild dog control in the northwest is the usual pandering to the Greens in return for votes. There's a real danger of that plan extending to the rest of Victoria. Dave says the shooting will continue despite the rule. And on that point, Ron says, just carry on regardless. 0467 842 722 is the text line, but we better get to rural news now with Emma Field.
G'day Angus. Regional communities say consultation on renewable energy projects have been a sham after the Victorian government yesterday moved to fast-track such projects and cut avenues of appeal. The state government say $90 billion of developments are being held up in red tape, and to bring down energy prices sooner, they'll accelerate them. They will remove the planning panel process, including third-party appeals, to the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, or VCAT. Moyne Shire Mayor Ian Smith wants assurances community concerns will be heard.
With the removal of the independent panel, it's just going to make it very hard for residents to have an input into any of these wind farm and renewable energy projects. We'll be going to the Minister, Premier and the Planning Minister just to put our case, really, that we still have an opportunity to have input into these projects. And with this removal, it's going to make it very difficult for us, and not having the panels that we can be represented at.
Australia's commercial gardening and nursery sector has gone public with its concerns about Bunnings, raising serious allegations against the company's market power and how it treats growers. Matt Brann reports.
GreenLife Industry Australia represents the $2.8 billion nursery industry and has told the Senate inquiry into supermarket pricing that it wants Bunnings to face the same scrutiny as Coles and Woolworths. Chief Executive Joanna Cave says Bunnings' massive market share has allowed it to dictate prices and supply of plants, and her members have had enough.
Bunnings has by far the largest market share when it comes to plant retail. They dominate that market to a degree of 70% as a monopoly, so much bigger than the supermarkets combined. That wouldn't be a problem, except that our growers experience a lot of the same trading inequities that suppliers into the supermarkets experience. Growers who really do feel that Bunnings have all the power in the relationship. They set the price, they control supply. There's an absence of proper enforceable legal contracts, a lot of verbal arrangements, all kinds of practices that would be in breach of the code were Bunnings covered by it, but they're not.
And when you think of rolled oats, you would think they'd be gluten-free. Well, as Kylie Hollins discovered, that isn't the case, which is why she founded GF Oats Australia. The Toowoomba teacher turned entrepreneur says her family has food intolerances, so she moved to importing gluten-free oats, which has a big market locally.
I had somebody email me around about 2007 and said, oh, I've just come back from the United States on a holiday and I've found this gluten-free oats. Do you have any? Do you know where you can get it from? And I went, I've never heard of it. I found a company up in Wyoming who happened to be a family of celiacs, and their son, Forrest, actually started this project in school to show that oats naturally are gluten-free. What happens is they're cross-contaminated through the supply chain. So many farmers grow oats, they grow wheat, or neighbours might grow rye and barley, and that's where the contamination happens. So through harvesters, trucking, processing. So to get oats that's not contaminated from wheat, rye and barley, you have to have exclusion zones.
The Guinness World Records have confirmed a New South Wales blueberry grown in Quirindi, north of Coffs Harbour, has weighed in at just over 20 grams and smashed the previous record. With a diameter close to the size of a ping pong ball, the fruit was grown at Costa Berries Farm last November. Brad Hocking from Costa Berries says it wasn't their intention to grow such a whopper berry.
No, absolutely not. It was, I guess over the years we have been, you know, in the great position to be growing some really improved blueberry genetics, blueberry varieties, and over time that has meant we are seeing some really exceptional fruit, and some of that is size, particularly last year where we had some really great growing conditions. Really good size across the crop, and just wanted to highlight some of the really excellent traits that we were seeing come through.
Yeah, I mean, the previous world record came in at 16.20 grams. I mean, so you've absolutely smashed that previous attempt. How did you do it?
Look, it's a combination of good breeding and good growing, I guess. We're really pleased and proud to be able to grow these varieties that have been developed here in Coffs Harbour.
And that's Rural News for this week.
Thanks, Emma. Emma Field there with Rural News. Let's head to the Bureau now. Senior forecaster Stephanie Miles is standing by. Afternoon, Stephanie.
Hi, Angus. How are you?
Oh, I'm enjoying this more temperate weather that we've been having in the second half of the week, Stephanie. It looks like it's going to be continuing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I am too. It looks really nice out there across the state at the moment. I mean, there is a couple of showers over Gippsland, but otherwise they're mostly cloud-free. As well, in the very northwest, there's a couple of really high atmospheric showers and thunderstorms. But you're right, it seems very settled across the state today. And it's really nice that those conditions look like they'll be continuing into the weekend as well. So first Saturday, Angus, we do have what I would call one of the most relatively settled days of the next ones that are coming up, with, you know, perhaps a little bit of fog around in the southeast tomorrow, but then a mostly sunny day with a chance of, again, some showers in the northwest, but otherwise a really nice settled day. And the temperature's very similar to what we're getting today, probably around the mid to high 20s tomorrow, across the state, really, perhaps getting up to about 30 degrees in Mildura, but look, a really nice day tomorrow once again. It's from Sunday onwards that we start to get a little bit more unsettled weather. So on Sunday, we do have our ridge to the east of us, and we're getting a bit of a trough moving into the very far western parts of the state, and it's staying quite stagnant throughout Sunday and Monday. And what that means is we've got some partly cloudy days, some warm temperatures, and perhaps some showers starting to build from the western parts of the state from Sunday and into Monday as well, with the chance maybe on Sunday of perhaps some, you know, thunderstorms with some heavy rainfall in the very far northwest. But then Monday, it's very similar conditions. And then by Tuesday, we actually have our next cold front coming through. So we've got some cooler southwesterly winds coming in, perhaps in the morning throughout the central parts, throughout the mid-morning or so, and then moving through the eastern parts overnight on Tuesday. And then by Wednesday, we're into that classic southerly flow under our next ridge. So showers on and south of the ranges from Wednesday onwards with some cooler conditions. But look, it's nice today, tomorrow, and then I think from Sunday and Monday is what we've got our eye on at the moment, Angus.
So those showers or possible thunderstorms next week, Stephanie, any indications on what sort of rainfall totals we might expect?
Yeah, absolutely. So on Sunday, in particular in the northwest over the Mallee with those thunderstorms, there could be a chance they're more isolated, so a bit more hit and miss here and there, but anywhere between maybe up to about 10 to 15 millimetres in the heaviest falls. But like we said, very isolated. They're not going to be consistently over that whole area. But then by Monday, it looks like we do have a little bit more settled conditions with less, you know, maybe 2 to 5 millimetres. But then on Tuesday, it's with that cold front that's coming through that we're expecting most of the rainfall. And I'd assume that it's going to be falling mostly on and south of and on the ranges, and perhaps in between, like in that southwest Gippsland area as well as the change comes through. But again, the totals that we're seeing is anywhere up from, you know, 5 to 15 millimetres or so. So not, you know, significant amounts, but after such a dry summer, it's definitely some that it's on the horizon, Angus.
Fair enough, Stephanie. Thanks for the update.
No worries. Thanks, Angus. Enjoy your afternoon.
You too. Stephanie Miles there, senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau, talking about, yeah, a little bit of rain around, some thunderstorms in the northwest Sunday, and then those showers on and south of the ranges into Tuesday, as Stephanie just told us. Lots of your texts coming through on this news that we've been telling you on the Country Hour today, that yesterday the state government, with the stroke of a pen essentially, it revoked the program to control dingoes and wild dogs in northwest Victoria. Run through some of your texts now. This person says, typical of the government, they had better get out on the ground and see for themselves what the dingoes and dogs are doing. They're in la-la land, says this texter from Dunkeld. Michael says, g'day Angus, in 2018 I was on a cattle station in outback South Australia. 300 dingoes we got in 1 year. Mind you, that was a drought too, says Michael. Thanks, Michael. This person says, Angus, it seems like the Victorian government wants to anger a lot of farmers with the change in the dingo policy and the dictator-like laws regarding renewable energy. Absolutely bloody disgraceful from our government, that texter says. And this person says, on a positive note, dingoes are proven inside the dingo fence to reduce fox, cat and kangaroo numbers. Kim says, hi Angus, I think given the Labor government's responses, and just to remind you what Kim's referring to there, we tried to get you a government response to this story on the Country Hour today. We tried the Environment Minister, they referred us to the Ag Minister, we haven't heard from the Ag Minister, and the Premier also declined to answer a question about this at a press conference in Gippsland this morning. So no response from the state government, despite our lack of trying. And just to emphasise as well that the Ag Minister particularly has never been on this program since she was appointed. Mary says, this is in reference to renewable energy projects across farmland. Mary says, those landholders around Newlyn and others are holding up transmission lines for years and the renewable power projects getting to where it's needed. Solar and wind farms don't really cover a big area of agriculture. Meanwhile, the world is beset by heatwaves, floods and fires. Thanks, Mary. And Mary also says governments have always had the right to put power lines across private property with proper compensation. 0467 842 722 is how you can get in touch on the text line.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Over the past few days, China has cancelled more than 500,000 tonnes of soft wheat in shipments it had ordered from the US. It's a record cancellation, and the Chicago wheat prices reacted, dropping to four-year lows before picking back up again. Denis Voznesensky from Combank also says it could be a sign China has found cheaper wheat elsewhere.
It's not out of the ordinary to see cancellations, but I think the reason this has really caught the attention of people is because of its size. In terms of why it's happening, well, we've been seeing prices decline quite considerably over the last couple of months, and actually we've been seeing prices decline ever since 2022 when we saw those record highs. And I think if you're looking at buyers overall, including China, they're looking at the market and they're saying, well, how low can prices get and how low can I buy the commodities that I need for, including wheat. Interestingly, we saw a decline initially, but now prices have actually started to move slightly higher. The reason as to why, it could be several. Maybe there's a little bit of a slowdown out of the Black Sea in terms of exports. I was hearing literally just over this week, this isn't in February, like we're going to have to wait and see what happens. But for the time being, it hasn't had a further negative impact on pricing so far.
So is this basically showing that China can get that wheat cheaper somewhere else when we look at the global wheat marketplace?
I think so. And it's also a bit of a waiting game. So from one perspective of that kind of waiting game is that right now there's large availability of wheat from the Black Sea. You have both Russia and Ukraine exporting significant quantities. So over February, Russia's expected to have exported a record volume of wheat. Ukraine's exported the most grain, at least in this marketing year that started last July. So there's a lot of wheat available on the market now. And then there's probably buyers in Asia and China going, well, what if we wait to mid-year? There's probably going to be even more grain around. So the prospects right now are for a good crop, both in Russia and Ukraine. And more importantly, in Russia, something we have to keep in mind is that there's a lot of grain still stored on farm, just like there is over here. And then we look at who else is going to be harvesting around mid-year. Well, we have the U.S. winter wheat crop that's going to have to be harvested. And they're coming out of their winter period right now. And if you look at the proportion of U.S. winter wheat area that's under drought conditions, it is only 14% right now compared to this time last year, where it was 46 to 47%. So right now, there's a lot of optimism in the market that there will be availability of grain around, whether that's wheat or corn from, for example, Brazil. And I think from China's perspective, they're going, well, maybe I can get some a little bit cheaper than what I can right now, or I could have over the last couple of weeks. Let's see how low prices can go overseas. And I think that's part of the reason. It's not to say that there aren't supportive factors out there for pricing. There is. It just might be part of the explanation for why China made these cancellations.
The conversation over the past, well, couple of years seems to always have been centred around the global shortage of wheat, that world wheat stocks were at record lows. That certainly seems the opposite of the picture that you've just painted and what you're expecting to come into that network in the next, say, 6 months or so.
There is more supplies around the world, especially for corn. So what we've done here at CBA is we forecasted the 24-25 marketing year and supply and demand for that year, so for the year ahead. The USDA, so the US Department of Agriculture, they haven't released the global forecast yet for that marketing year. We have. Again, for corn, availability is expected to rise quite considerably. For wheat, stocks are expected to rise a bit, but it's not that much. And if you look at some of the main producing regions around the world, well, Canada's in drought and they're going into their full swing planting in May. So the forecast isn't for any improvement there. Argentina right now is looking good going into, they're also planting around May. But there's the possibility of La Nina returning halfway through the year. And that usually means dry conditions in Argentina. And right now, a lot of farmers in Argentina are actually concerned that the margins they can make aren't worthwhile because the cost of production is getting higher than the price they can actually receive. In Australia, very large parts in WA that are still very dry. You go to Esperance and Albany, and cropping regions around there are very dry. You look at Western Victoria, you look at South Australia, that's also very dry. And that's all supportive of pricing. And the other two factors that I think are important is that consumers in Asia have been kind of putting off their purchases, waiting for prices to get lower. Eventually, they're going to have to come back to the market. And secondly, the possibility of disruptions to Black Sea exports hasn't really gone anywhere. And as we head into U.S. elections this year, it might actually get a lot more volatile. So it was only a couple of weeks ago we saw when a Greek minister came to Ukraine and they were in the Odessa region where a lot of those big ports are. And there was an attack very close by, and there's been a lot of Russian vessels heading to their ports, Russian ports that have been attacked recently as well. And it basically shows that the capability to disrupt trade flows is very real, and it's there, and it's possible for both countries to do. They just haven't done it yet. There's a lot of risk remaining.
That was agri and sustainability economist at CBA, Dennis Vosnesensky, speaking to Joe Prendergast. Lots of your texts on our dingo story. Daniel in the Northwest says, I'm a farmer from the Northwest working on a family farm, and the government's call to cease wild dog baiting is an absolute joke. Wild dog and fox populations will grow dramatically as we can say goodbye to your small native animals and our production of prime lambs in the Northwest. This person says, after we told you that the Ag Minister won't come on the Country Hour, they say, does the Ag Minister even know what the Country Hour is? And is that the person making decisions on our behalf? All over it. Yeah, nah. This person says, Jeff says, Angus, this government's latest dog act is the killing off of the timber industry all over again, only listening to experts and academics who say what they want to hear. Thanks for your text, Jeff, 0467 842 722. Let's talk Q fever now, though, because it's estimated only 10 to 20% of people who need a vaccine for Q fever can access it. Dr. Stephen Graves, whose lab is in the process of developing a new vaccine, says the current jab is expensive and inaccessible. Lucy Cooper filed this story.
Q fever is a bacterial disease that's typically spread when people inhale air or dust from soil containing bacteria from animal feces or birth products, including while mowing the lawn. It's a disease that can lead to long-term health impacts, according to Dr. Stephen Donoghue, director of the Public Health Unit in Townsville.
Sometimes it's mild and just like a flu, but often people get quite a severe fever that lasts for a long time. They're really unwell, very tired. They can get rashes, joint pains. Sometimes they get liver disease or kidney disease and end up in hospital. A small number of the cases actually become chronic, and that means that it can last for a long time and cause abscesses inside the body and even turn up again years later when your immune system is off guard.
In Queensland, Q fever infections have spiked. There have been 89 reported infections of Q fever across the state so far this year, an increase of almost 90% on the same time in 2023. This spike has perplexed Dr. Donoghue.
This is actually unusually high. And the other thing that has got us a bit mystified is that it's not like it's been really dry and dusty so far. So given that it has been relatively wet, that is a big number.
It's a disease not to be underestimated. Alan Parker knows that better than others. He had Q fever in the late 90s.
I had a temperature and I was ill for 3 days. I felt really unwell and I started passing blood in my urine. The doctor at the time, he came and said, oh dear, something terribly wrong with you. We've done all the tests. He said, I think you've either got Wheals disease or Q fever. It was a rocky night and the next day I felt a lot better. But yeah, I was 5 days in hospital. It's not to be underestimated.
Alan Parker, who is now the manager of the Kalamia Cane Growers Organisation in North Queensland, wants to remind people to get vaccinated.
I went from being quite healthy, and I believe, and I'm not just saying this, but I believe it's contributed to a certain extent my health from still today, where sometimes you don't feel right. You still get that same feeling or that sort of unhealthiness, and that all stems back from me catching Q fever. Now, there is lots of complications. Don't start reading up on it because it'll make you feel even worse. If it's still prevalent and relevant out there in the paddock, geez, it's something that I thought that they would be well on top of, and not currently find ourselves in an escalated cases around Australia.
But getting vaccinated isn't easy or accessible.
I would estimate only about 10 to 20% of people who really need the vaccine actually get the vaccine. And that is a major accessibility problem. It's partly because a lot of people don't know about the vaccine. It's about doctors not being willing to give the vaccine.
That's Dr. Stephen Graves. He's the founder and medical director of the Australian Rickettsial Reference Laboratory. He believes the government sees Q fever vaccines as something only abattoir workers need, rather than everybody in rural and regional Australia. Dr. Graves says this assumption has seen cost arise as a barrier to vaccination.
Even though it's subsidised by the government, it's still quite expensive because you've got your two doctor's appointments. It's okay if the doctor bulks bill, but if they don't, you've got two doctor's fees. You've got to have a laboratory test done, which will cost a certain amount of money. And then the vaccine itself costs over $100. So to actually get someone vaccinated, you're probably looking at at least $350 maybe. And not everybody's got that sort of money. And the principle should be that vaccines like this that are life-saving and crucial should be available free for Australian citizens. Other vaccines are available free. Why not this one?
Australia is the only country in the world that has a Q fever vaccine for humans. Dr. Graves says the vaccine, known as QVAX, could be better.
It's a two-stage process. The patient has to have these two lots of testing first, and then they have to come back, have the skin test read by the doctor, and if both tests are negative, then the doctor can give the vaccine. So it's very inconvenient. It's very time-consuming, particularly for country people and like in outback Australia, and especially outback Queensland, where the incidence is so high. They've got to get to a doctor that offers the vaccine, maybe a town, you know, a long way away.
In 2020, Dr. Graves was tasked with creating a new Q fever vaccine that's cheaper and more accessible.
The problem with QVAX is that it's what we call reactogenic, and that means that some people have a bad reaction to it. And as you know, people are very concerned about vaccine safety now. So we're trying to develop a vaccine that's as good as QVAX. It won't be better because it's such a good vaccine, but as good as QVAX, but is not reactogenic, so that it doesn't have the high risk of patients having a bad reaction to the vaccine.
Next year, the trial should reach phase one, which is human trials.
And yes, they hope that that new vaccine will be available in 5 years. And that was Dr. Stephen Graves sending that story from Lucy Cooper. Well, what were you up to as a 12-year-old? I bet you weren't shearing sheep, let alone 130 in a day, like 12-year-old Charlie Dunn from Colcan. He told Faith Tabaluyan how it felt to shear his new personal best.
Is that all you want, mate? You haven't got much.
Oh, it was so good, because Dad only shore 126, and I was rubbing it in. I still rub it in a bit now. Yeah, it was pretty cool to finally achieve something, like to, get it done and,
Had you been training for that?
No, I just shear whenever we shear at home. Like, Dad crutches me out, takes the belly off. We've only really started doing that past year or two. Yeah, I guess.
And so you do juggle your shearing with school and helping out on the farm as well. So what does your typical day look like?
Oh, whenever you can get a possible day off, you take it. We went and got these in to shear them today, and then we went up to our lease block and we marked their lambs. And, I think there was 108 of them, so we marked them and then rushed home here and about to shear these ones.
And I heard from a little birdie, a.k.a. your mum, that you much prefer being in the shearing shed to being in the classroom. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Like school, you have to sit down and not much physical side of it, and it's boring.
Do you see yourself becoming a full-time shearer in the future?
Well, I want to be, but we just got to get there yet, chip away and see when we can get there.
You're heading down to the Wodonga show this weekend, so what do you have to do to prepare for that?
Dad crutches me out, takes the belly off, and then, shear them, and then, they pay me $800 to drive up there and come back and shear them, so that will be fun.
What are you going to do with your $800?
Put it in my bank account.
Nice. What do you love about cheering, if you could sum it up?
Oh, I love the long blow and the last side. Like, just taking the wool off, like, as you go. And I love the ones that sit there, not the ones that don't. And then it's, because they're long blows. Yeah, they're nice and long and you can kind of get there and it's, like, easier. It's, like, funner to do.
And Charlie's mum, Donna, says Charlie and his older sister, Matilda, pull more than their weight on the family farm.
Yeah, we've always done all our own shearing and the kids just had to come with us and do what we were doing before they went to school. And that's why they both developed a love of farming and helping on the farm. And when we were shearing, Charlie just wanted to help as well and started sort of to teach him himself. And then in the end, Clint's like, well, I've got to show him the right way how to do it because he's going to do it anyway. And every year he's helped out shearing the lambs and shearing more and more each time.
It's a pretty big commitment being the mum of a young shearer. So what does that involve?
Lots of holding your breath. When he was younger and used to shear and you used to hope that nothing would go wrong. And touch wood, he hasn't hurt himself or any shape. And yeah, it's a big job driving him around to all these shows that ask him to shear. And yeah, but he loves it, so I love it.
What a great kid. That was Donna Dunn, proud mum of 12-year-old shearer Charlie Dunn, speaking with Faith Tabaluyan. Just about it for the Country Hour. Jenny says on transmission lines, if no farms, no food. Pretty simple message there that I've abbreviated. Thanks for that one, Jenny. Well, Warwick Long will be back in the Country Hour chair on Monday. Have a great weekend. News time.